Hello, I'm Maggie Wilson, and currently for 3 days a week, 5 days a fortnight actually, at Stockport Grammar School.
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your home background, your parents and your schooling and the way you were taught at school?
I was very fortunate really. My parents are both doctors and I went to a Montessori nursery school from the age of four, and then with my great friends that I made at nursery, we moved to the junior department of Sheffield Girls High School, which of course was private GPDSD school, very academic. I quite enjoyed the junior department. Wasn't very happy in the senior school. I think it was very pressured, and I'm sure it gave me a good education, and I came out with a reasonable crop of O-levels. At that stage we moved up to Glasgow, and I went to another girls' private school in Glasgow to do Scottish Highers. Loved that, just really settled in very, very well, and went on to do A-levels, stayed on for the extra year to do A-levels. Didn't do brilliant in my A-levels because I'd already got a university place at St Andrews to do history. So my sixth form at Laurel Bank was an easy ride, really. But anyway, I enjoyed it. It was good fun. Then I had 4 years at St Andrews doing modern history. Then got my first teaching job. No, then I went, obviously, to Jordan Hill College to do the training and got my first teaching job.
Your first teaching job in Ayrshire?
Yes, in Kilmarnock, in a primary school. And I'd opted to become a primary teacher because I loved history. I really enjoyed history. I was fascinated by history, but I just thought that teaching it for exams would absolutely ruin it, that all the kind of detail and the intricacy and the research and the delving into the archives and stuff was not what you taught in school, and I just thought I wasn't interested in teaching it in school. But I was very interested in children as well, and child development, and not exactly psychology, because I didn't want to do it as an academic thing, but the sort of way children learnt, I found all that fascinating. And when I'd done the teacher training, I'd done a diploma in education at Glasgow University parallel to that, and the education and psychology bit we'd done of that was all about the child development and how children learn. So I mean I was really very comfortable going into primary school, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to teach children rather than teach history. So
that's good, because that tells me why you went into primary. But did you actually learn to teach history at all when you were at Jordan Hill? Was there any emphasis on delivering history as opposed to anything else?
No, absolutely not. And I mean, I was trying to remember what I was taught about teaching history at Jordan Hill. I can remember learning how to teach maths and being told that you had to underline and you had to recite your tables and things like that, and the tutor nearly driving me nuts. I don't remember doing any history at all at Jordan Hill, but we must, I think, have done some kind of cross-curricular humanities sort of history geography work, but I don't remember it. It must have been unimportant as part of the thing. At teaching practice, again, I remember teaching English and maths, but I don't remember teaching history. I think that the history part of all the primary bit back then was very much a separate subject, but part of making projects and doing kind of using English particularly. Not cross-curricular in perhaps the modern sense, but certainly using a lot of the different elements of primary teaching to make a project in which history would be part of it.
Were you teaching mainly Key Stage 2, as would be now?
Yes. But I didn't teach just Key Stage 2. I did teach reception, and I taught first years as well, a bit. And I do remember some of the children bringing in objects. And so I'm sure we did some history. Where we were asking the children about their more recent past, about their what they remembered or what their parents remembered about what had happened to them. I can remember the children bringing in like their dad's medals from the war and that kind of thing. So perhaps their granddad's medals. Anyway, we definitely must have done some kind of local, personal type history, as well as the kind of project stuff. And I think we did the Romans. I seem to vaguely remember things about Romans, but I don't remember any detail about it. I'm not sure.
And that's the same when you were working in Scotland, and then subsequently when you were working in London.
Yes.
You didn't do any special history trips or...
Now, trips, that's interesting. I don't think so, but having said that, certainly when I was in Kilmarnock in Ayrshire, the school was in a very poor area on a very poor housing estate, and I don't remember us going on any trips anywhere at all apart from a nature walk. I remember doing a nature walk, which had nothing to do with history. Then when I was up in Ross and Cromarty, we did it was just odd little bits of supply, so I wasn't kind of involved in any long-term teaching there. And then when I taught in Saudi Arabia, we didn't leave the compound where the school was. It was all in a big compound, and it was right through from 4 up until 14 in Saudi. But I had a Key Stage 2 class then, there were 10. But I don't remember going out on any visits. But we definitely did some Saudi Arabian history, because I can remember taking an artifact and sort of incense burners and brass jugs and things that we'd managed to pick up. So we must have done some Saudi history. Then when we came back to London, I think at that stage we must have done some trips from that school. But I can only remember going to a church and to a synagogue and to a... temple of some kind. It was Gujarati area.
That sounds more like religious
studies, doesn't it? That's right. I don't remember doing any history ones, which is really strange actually, because I would have thought primary schools went on trips.
How did you come to move to the middle school in Bradford?
Well, I moved from London up to Bradford, and the first year I didn't work at all, and then after that I decided I'd have to go back to work, but I did supply to start with. Never come across middle schools before, didn't know anything about them really, slightly nervous, but I was offered work in a middle school and found that I absolutely loved it, and they then offered me, well, it was a long-term supply job, the very first one, it turned out to be, and I just thought, this is my area, this is what I want to do. And that was the first time that I really did teach history as a proper subject. And
were you recruited as a history teacher?
No, I was recruited as a primary teacher, and I taught year five in that first job. But we did do history as a discrete subject at middle school, even with year five. And that would be in the early... about 1990, so just beginning national curriculum. And we certainly taught, well, in year five we did Romans and medieval, which was national curriculum, beginning of the chronological stuff. And it really, I don't think, I mean, most of it wasn't my creation, because I was on a supply basis, I didn't have an awful lot of input into the history bit until I got... I had a year's contract, a proper temporary contract, and at that stage I did get involved. And the colleague that I was working with was very, very enthusiastic at doing big things. And he set up an English Civil War camp where we took the children. It was a cross-curricular humanities thing, so they were looking at sort of the geography of the area as well. But basically, the children slept in tents. It lasted for a week, and they were half the year group were there for the first half of the week, and then the second half of the year group went for the second half of the week, and they had costumes and they cooked over open fires and all sorts of things like this, and dressed up in uniform and saw reenactments and things. And I know it's a later question, but I just think that will never ever be forgotten by those children. If you want to make children engage, then give them the experience to live through it, and it's something they'll never ever forget. And I think that was an eye-opener really to me, I think.
That is one of the questions, you know, what you think turns children on to learning history.
Yes. Well, I think visits and hands-on experience is just there are other things you can do, but that to me is what's going to stick in their mind. If you ask children what they remember about history, I think it'll be the visits. It's when we went to so and so, and when we did this. And at one stage, one of the middle schools I was at, it was the one where I actually stayed for a decent length of time, and I was taking charge. We used to have a couple who came in with a whole lot of, I mean, it would happen to be Civil War stuff as well, but they brought in pikes and they had stuff for the children to dress up in, and they had helmets and breastplates and they had the muskets and they showed them how to work it. And they acted out a kind of story and involved the children. And if I asked at the end of the year what was the highlight, it was always those kind of things where they'd been able to get up and do. And when I think back to my own history education, I don't remember very much about it, and I'm sure it's because there weren't really very many highlights. An awful lot of it was just going through the motions and going learning the facts and things. I enjoyed it though, so it wasn't all bad. And obviously, although I can't remember specific things, I do know quite a lot of history, so it went in, but it just doesn't stand out as anything specific about what I learned.
When the children took part in the camp, were they preparing for it by learning about the Civil War and then relating it back to what they learned, their experience?
Yes, it was tied in with what we did in the classroom, both before and the follow-up afterwards. They must have been year eight. Yeah, they must have been year eight to be doing that period. I mean, the Civil War is not something that's really been taught very much in schools until the national curriculum came in. I don't really think the Stuarts would ever have been, especially in England, ever have been a particularly important part of the curriculum until the national curriculum brought it in. But it's become a period that I love teaching, actually. Well, I just think the 17th century is great. It's fascinating. Anyway.
Do you think it's as widely taught now, actually, as it was in the start of the national curriculum? Because there's all this, you know, it's all too much of the Tudors, too dominant.
I think it's easy. It's one of the periods that is probably dropped or skated over or squeezed in as a kind of overview picture. There aren't very many teachers who enjoy it. A lot of teachers will engage with the Tudors, and maybe we'll recognise they have to teach the Victorians, but an awful lot of the younger teachers that I work with are really much more interested in the 20th century than anything else. And I mean, possibly the Tudors, and obviously you go through the motions of the medieval bit with the younger children and so on, but I've found very, very few people are interested in the Stuarts.
Why do you think it is?
I think it's probably their own background knowledge, I suspect. It's very hard, because I know that whenever I thought that I wasn't going to be interested in 20th century history, and when I had to teach it, apart from the First World War, which has always interested me, I suppose it's just one of those topics where you get involved with individuals, but the other stuff, I just thought, well, I'll go through the motions, just like other people perhaps go through the Stuarts. But then the more I read and the more I learn, the more interesting it got. So the first time I ever had to teach Russian history, I thought, oh, crikey, what a drag. But actually, I'm absolutely fascinated by Stalin and by the way he controlled the Soviet Union and things like this. And I just never imagined that it would be something I would find interesting. But now I read quite a lot. So I do think that probably the reason that history teachers aren't interested in the Stuarts, or don't get nearly so involved, I mean, none of us teach the 18th century, but I think it's probably our own comfort zones and knowledge. And I think that if you said you must, then you do the reading and you would get interested, I think. Maybe it's a male-female thing too, of course, because the men like the wars and the military stuff. I don't know.
Most commentators agree that the national curriculum had a big effect on history teaching. I mean, did it affect the middle school curriculum enormously, or was it just a little bit of adaptation?
I don't know what they taught before, but I know that when I went to Wyke, which is where I did 5 years, we really took on board the national curriculum. And in fact, I was there for a term, and then they were told that they were going to have an Ofsted inspection, which of course was also coming in at the same time, and there was a lot of panic. And they hadn't really had a proper history coordinator before, and I was asked if I'd like to do it. And I just got really involved. And it was around about that time that I discovered SHP, and probably the Historical Association, actually. I think it was only then, when I regarded myself as fundamentally a history teacher. I was teaching about 50% history and 50% English, but I wasn't teaching a great deal as bits of RE and bits of PSE, but really I was a history and English teacher with ICT. And I really took the history on board, and I started going to the SHP conferences and the HA conferences, and just kind of completely opening up what I was doing. I know, although I can't remember what I taught before, that I had never taught history in that way and never looked at it in that way. I shall never ever forget the first SHP conference that I went to. I think the very first of those kinds of conferences must have been a Historical Association one, and I went for the day and I went to workshops, and it was the beginning of a revelation. But the first SHP conference I went to, Christine Council did a plenary session, and she talked about extended writing, and I was just absolutely blown away. It wasn't even kind of inquiry based stuff at that stage. It was still very, very early days for what Christine was developing, but it was just this idea that you could actually really get children to do a big inquiry. I mean, she didn't call it inquiry, but a big study, and then write an essay and how to structure it. And I just, that was it. I was hooked, and I haven't missed an SHP conference since, I don't think. I'm sure I haven't. And I've just learnt so much. And you just, every time you go, there's more ideas about how to engage the children and different ways of looking at it. And I just wish that more history teachers would go, because I think there are elements of the national curriculum still, and even, I mean, there's the revised national curriculum now, but that's kind of been more of a tweak, I think, but that people are not really looking at things like interpretations and diversity with any kind of understanding if they haven't been to or read about these new ideas for teaching history. I just think it's tokenistic a lot of the time.
I wanted to ask you whether the SHP chimed with your child development ideas.
Quite possibly, I think. I think probably there's a lot of interest in that, because it is to do with how you get children to learn, and I still haven't lost that interest. It still fascinates me to think about what you're going to get to get the children to respond, and how you're going to support them to produce a really clear explanation of what they want to say, because they find it really hard, especially in a school like the secondary school I ended up in before I went to Stockport, because they found history really difficult. And it used to frustrate me that children who were really engaged with history and could talk to you, not perhaps terribly articulately, but with a lot of knowledge and a lot of understanding about how events impacted on one another and how events have relevance to the present day, and yet they couldn't get good grades in their GCSEs because they didn't have those literacy skills to be able to analyse and evaluate and things in an essay form. And it just really, really upsets me that they couldn't do that. So yeah, I think probably looking at how children learn is still a big part, and I think SHP does chime with that quite well.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So in some ways you found the national curriculum supportive?
Yes, I think so, yes.
Yeah.
I think especially as I happen to kind of grow in with it. I mean, perhaps if I'd taken over as history coordinator back in whenever it was, 93 or 94, I think, without the national curriculum, I don't know that I would have known where to start particularly, and I probably would just have picked up things that other people had done. But because the national curriculum was coming in, and because I'd got all these new ideas from SHP as well, I was really...
National curriculum.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes, yes. I think I found it very helpful, I think, having that kind of structure. The levelling bit was perhaps the most restrictive and the most difficult element of it. I think laying out the chronology was useful. And it made sense. I mean, okay, we've had to go back and have another look at it, but I think it did make sense. And it actually was really nice because when you met up with colleagues, and we did at that stage in Bradford, there was still a history advisor in the local authority, and she would organise meetings of middle school history teachers where we could exchange ideas. And because we had the national curriculum, we had so much in common, we could really share resources and really share ideas and really talk about things that were useful, and it was great. The levelling was a pain, really, and especially right back at the beginning when there were, I can't remember how many different bits there were, but hundreds and one of different kind of levels and things. And I don't think we did that well at all. I think probably it was a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and you didn't worry too much about it. But the rest of it, yeah, good.
Good. So what do you think should be the balance between the sort of learning skills and the content of history?
I think you've got to have both, because I think without a narrative and a context and a story, you're not really going to engage children. I think you've got to, it's got to make sense to them. So you've got to have that content, and that's what's going to grab them. But on the other hand, I think you can get them interested. Like, I'm really, really keen on archaeology. It's another kind of more recent thing that I've had. But if I talk to them about archaeology, or I quite often do kind of practical archaeology exercises, pretend, but usually. We haven't done any real archaeology with the children, sadly, but I've sometimes taken a trough of, it's different layers of sand and soil and different kinds of grow baggy stuff, and bury things in it and at different levels. And, you know, it promotes a lot of discussion, and that's all to do with skills. That's, well, why is this here, and why is this, why have we found this higher up in the trough than other things, and what does that tell us, and who might have been there? And I mean, that's analysing sources in a very hands-on kind of way. But then you can quite easily go on to say, well, okay, here's a document, we can have a look at this, how's this going to back up what we've found in the layers and so on, and then does the source really tell us that, and can we trust it, and why isn't it quite agreeing? And you can easily do that, and it's important that they understand, because otherwise, and I think especially now with the internet, they could easily be taken off down a complete blind alley that could be completely wrong, and unless they learn to be reflective about it and to analyse what they're looking at and to understand that there are different points of view and different ways of looking at the different kinds of evidence, then it's just so easy to be wrong, to be mistaken, to take things at face value. And that's actually a skill they need, not just for history, but for living nowadays. Mm. And of course, I mean, I absolutely 100% think that history is just essential for life.
So you were responsible for history in the middle school.
Hmm.
Was it very discrete subjects then? Because that's a big change, isn't it? Because they've moved from having more topic-based, project-based, to single subjects.
Yes, yes.
So did you not get a trend back towards having cross-curricular projects at some point?
Not at the middle school, no, not at all. I think partly because I was a historian and there was a geographer as well, and I wasn't being asked to do both subjects, so my class went to the geography teacher for their geography lessons. perhaps if I'd been in a school where there had only been a humanities specialist, then would have been more cross-curricular topic. But in the school I happened to be in, we were very definitely separate subjects. And I mean, we all had our own national curriculum folder and all the rest of it, and these things we had to do. So I suspect that they were discrete subjects in most middle schools until 2000, when the middle schools closed. Then in secondary, there was no move for cross-curricular until about, I think probably about 2006, 2007, they started to creep in with this kind of, maybe we need to look, especially for year seven, maybe we need to look at cross-curricular approaches and so on. And it was not good. It just wasn't, because the history, in the secondary school I was in, the people who were planning it were not historians. So the history that they were going to include was not what I would call history. It was not good history. It was, we'll do a topic on, I can't remember, Egypt. So you kind of bring in a bit about hieroglyphs and pyramids and things, but it wasn't proper, rigorous history where you've got a real depth inquiry. It was putting together a nice little project and helping them to do some better English, which isn't such a bad thing, but as far as the history was concerned, it wasn't going to work. It was going to be a disaster.
In your survey form, you actually mentioned quite a lot, I'm jumping ahead, about the use of the media and, you know, TV and such things. Do you think teaching in the middle school, you had a bit more time to spend on using visual aids and other resources?
Possibly, yes. Although I think that continued into the secondary school.
How many hours a week would you have for history?
At middle school?
Mm.
I think we probably did 2 hours a week.
Right.
But I can't remember exactly, and of course I wouldn't dilute it down, because that was my kind of passion. I seem to remember that we did a kind of rotational thing for geography and history, so that in year seven, I think, they did for a term or a term and a half, they did 2 hours of history and an hour of geography, and then they swapped over, I think, halfway through the year.
Middle school goes from year five
up to the end of year eight.
So yes. From year five they were getting discrete history lessons.
Yes. Because I was providing materials for the year five teacher. We had two Ofsted inspections in the 5 years that I was there, and so I can remember, I know for certain I was providing discrete things, and they were doing the Victorians and were really getting involved with that, and they used the How We Used to Live series, and a lot of their teaching was based around that. And I can remember having a few reservations about it, simply because I felt that some lessons they might spend 40 minutes watching two of the episodes from How We Used to, because the Victorian How We Used to Live was very, very, very long. I thought it was super stuff, but it was very long, and I think altogether they were, I can't remember how many episodes, but if they had to bring in and they did Invaders and Settlers as well, I think, in year five. I can't remember exactly, but anyway, they certainly had to do another topic. And if they were going to do the whole of How We Used to Live, it did sometimes mean they were kind of overkill on the television. So I was trying to wean them off a bit that. But the trouble is, the story was so good as far as the kids were concerned and the teachers that they didn't want to miss any of it.
That's lovely. And you mentioned a museum that you created.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I've still got... Yeah, I collect up artifacts, but principally anything at all that's a bit junky. And I had a really, really big... It was an old-fashioned Victorian school, and I had big windows with big windowsills. And I just used to put a whole range of different artifacts for the children just to come in and handle. I just thought it was really good for them to ask questions, and they weren't necessarily related. Sometimes they're related to the topic we were doing, and certainly getting Victorian and for the topic on Britain since 1930, it was really easy to get materials and things and let them talk about it and let them handle stuff and things. But I mean, I've got odd bits of Roman pottery and odd bits of tesserae and helmets from the Second World War. And anything at all that I could take in that wasn't going to get damaged. And I also had smaller things in a small display cabinet with sort of questions like, can you imagine where this came from, and so on. And one of the courses I went on, there was a chap there who introduced me to a book called, a puffin paperback called The Sandal, which is all about, I mean, I just think it's magic. It's now out of print, but it is available on Amazon, and I keep telling people about it. But it's all about basically a little girl who loses her sandal, and you kind of follow through the idea from the Roman times to the modern, to the future. And there's a whole lot of continuity, because in the Roman times there's a Roman statue, the Roman children play on the Roman statue, and then you see it in the museum in present day, and then you see it in the museum of the future. And each time that you see it, it's lost a bit more of its arms or its legs or whatever. And then this sandal, the original sandal, is in the present day museum, but then it's a modern replica of the Roman style of sandal that's in the future museum. So you've got all this kind of continuity bit, but the whole point really is to try and get the children to see that at some stage all the artifacts that we have, all these things that I had on display, had belonged to real people. And you know, to try and imagine how they had come to be on my windowsill. What was the story behind them being abandoned or whatever, you know? And I just think that's exciting history, that kind of stuff. So yes, I had a class museum, which was actually commented on by the Ofsted inspector, for which I was very pleased. But it was just a source of stimulus, really, to get them to think.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, though, was whether in the middle school particularly, but also in the secondary school, you felt that children were picking up a sense of chronology. Because in fact, Key Stage 2 and Key Stage 3 don't form a single chronological overview, do they?
No, I mean, Key Stage 3 sort of rushes through the whole lot.
Yeah.
And no, Key Stage 2 sort of had had subjects that weren't going to necessarily feed into Key Stage 3. I don't know. I mean, at the time, I thought that they did, and I always had timelines around the classroom and would always be saying, this is where we are, and pointing to the relevant bits and things. But all the research says that actually they haven't really developed that sense of chronology that you would expect from teaching chronologically. And I think it's perhaps because you didn't, you know, as a teacher, we didn't tend to refer back enough, perhaps, that you might have a timeline, but you would concentrate on the bit, you know, you'd get the children to focus on the bit that you were studying, and perhaps you didn't refer back enough and say, do you remember last year and this following? You kind of make assumptions that they do remember, but in actual fact, if you ask children, and I have done since, can you remember when we did this? And they will look at you blankly as if you've never ever taught the whole thing, which is slightly horrifying, but is a fact. I mean, sometimes you can give them memory joggers and prompters, but they do need that sometimes to remember what they've learned. So I think perhaps our expectations of what they memorise in a real knowledge way is wrong. I think they don't get that automatic kind of overview picture of how things have developed. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, well, I don't know why not. I wonder whether underneath it's there, you know, kind of subconsciously, that there is more chronological understanding, and it does need to be actually drawn out. Because I don't remember, as I said before, I don't remember specifically when I learned history. And yet, at some stage, I don't think I waited till I was at university or even doing A-level. I think I had reasonable chronological understanding at some stage during my teenage years. I don't remember being specifically taught, but I just think it kind of emerged.
But did you do the traditional curriculum where you started with cavemen and went through to astronauts, you know, sort
well,
of right through?
Not really, because I suppose I probably did. I probably did in junior school. We probably did start with the cavemen and went through. But I know that I did the French Revolution twice. So I think once I got to the age of 14 and I was doing O-level, then we weren't doing it through. And it just so happened that when I moved up to Scotland, that's what they were doing for their hire. So I did the French Revolution
twice. That was a
common
problem, wasn't it, before
yes,
the National Curriculum?
Very much anyway. So, yes.
Talking about issues that we remember, etc., but do you think it's important for history in school to promote a sense of national identity? Is there enough British history?
I think it's a very, very, very difficult question. I think there is enough British history. I think, by and large, most of what we do is British history, really, honestly. We sometimes will look at a more European-based or a world-based topic, but basically studying British English. I was going to use that as and correct myself and say British, but actually, no, I think we teach English history mostly. And I don't know to what extent it creates national identity, and I don't know how successful we are at really looking at the kind of local personal stuff that would give individuals any sense of identity within a community. I don't know how important that is. I think people growing up in this country need to have a kind of context for where they are and their place. And that means that's the non-white ethnic minority populations as well. They need to have some idea of where they've come from and how they fit in. But I'm frightened of saying, yes, you've got to use history to create a sense of identity, because I just think that could become a political agenda and we could then be forcing things which I wouldn't be comfortable with.
When you were teaching in Bradford, were you teaching in a multi-ethnic school?
Not really. We did have Asian children, but really, honestly, we weren't. But it was quite noticeable that there were very, very few of the Asian children who were interested in doing GCSE history. And I think that was because, really, they weren't engaged. They worked hard and they would go through the motions, but I don't think that they really engaged with the history that we were offering them, the national curriculum history that we were offering them. And, I mean, you know, I had to teach diversity, so I did my little token bit of diversity. And we would have a look a little bit at... I did do a unit on immigration into Bradford in the 1950s and 60s, and I got the audio tape that the Bradford Heritage Unit made, and we did some work on that. And that was interesting, but it was a token. It was... I'm going to be doing diversity, so what am I going to do? And this is the most relevant to what my class has. But I don't feel it was really, really honestly engaging the Asian children in school. Not really, honestly.
Alongside that, you were saying about the danger of political considerations coming in. You have the mandatory topics that are now in the national curriculum, the slave trade and the Holocaust, which has been in from the original. Those are two that have been sort of picked out as being important for children. Do you think that history has that role to play of creating values in children, of tolerance or appreciating the importance of avoiding, if you like, a genocide?
Well, I think the slave trade and the Holocaust, and I mean the British Empire is another one that's compulsory, are very, 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 very relevant to the context, the global context now, in a kind of political, economic, everything kind of sense. So it's not just the moral and ethical things that I think make the Holocaust and the slave trade important. So I don't think it's just from that. But when I teach the Holocaust, my big driving point is, why did it happen? And how can we make sure it doesn't happen again? And I think that's got to be an important part of teaching the Holocaust, because I think children have got to start reflecting on their own position. And it ties in very, very much in Bradford, when I was in Bradford, because there is this kind of underlying racism And I try and, I mean, I did. I encouraged them to try and see that allowing underlying racism was like underlying anti-Semitism in Germany. And it means that if things get much, much worse, then turning a blind eye is going to be the easy option if that's what you've always done. If you've allowed racism to kind of creep in, then at what stage do you stand up to be counted? And I mean, that's the thing I say to them. And I think, yeah, I think history has got a role to play, but I don't want the government to... I think it's right that they've made the Holocaust compulsory, but I don't want the government to start saying exactly how it's got to be taught and using it as a kind of moral tool. I really don't want that kind of political interference.
So you think it's safer left in the hands of teachers?
Well, I don't know, actually, that's very true, because you could get a really dreadful teacher, couldn't you? I mean, well, the GTC have allowed a BNP teacher, haven't they? So, I mean, who knows if it was in that... So, yeah, that's difficult. I don't know.
It's a conundrum.
Yes, it very much so.
Recent trends in the school curriculum seem to be squeezing the time available for history. Now, I know you've just moved schools, but... You know, how highly rated is history being in the schools where you've taught?
Well, I mean, Stockport Grammar, it, private school, it's very highly, big take-up, highly esteemed. It's regarded as a difficult, challenging, rigorous academic subject, and the children want to do well who do it. And we get a lot who get A stars at GCSE and a lot who go on to do A level. And it's one of the subjects that they reckon that universities look for if they want someone who's got a very rounded and intelligent and educated kind of approach to things. And also quite a lot of them want to go on to do history or law or whatever at university anyway. So Stockport, they're into problem. At other schools, it is a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. When I was doing the regional subject advisory job, there was one school I went into where they had reduced history to just year 7 and 8. Their take-up at GCSE was very low, and in year 7 they did... I think they actually did 2 lessons a week, but they weren't a full hour. I think they did 50-minute lessons. And in year 8 they only had 1 lesson a week, and that was it. Whole entitlement for history. And if they didn't do GCSE, that was it. And there was no way they were going to be able to get through any kind of national curriculum, revised, content reduced or anything. I mean, it was just going to be a complete skim through, and it was just horrendous. It's appalling. and I think it's a very, very, very retrograde step. Having said that, I think if you're going to make history compulsory, I would like to make it... I think it's a diabolical that they're dropping it in year 9, and a lot of schools, a huge number of schools, are going to 2-year key stage 3 for history, and I think that's dreadful. But if you decided to make it compulsory till 16, I think you've got to come up with some better way. Not just a GCSE, because I think the kids at Stockport are right. It is challenging, academic, rigorous, blah blah blah, and the kids at Wyke found it really, really hard. And it is wrong. If you've only got a GCSE, which is going to be really difficult for them, if they haven't got good levels of literacy, then you're setting them up to fail, and therefore you're forcing them to do a subject for which they are going to have no liking, and only a sense of failure, and that's absolutely, totally wrong.
I just wanted to pick up what you said there about the regional advisory role.
Oh, right, yeah.
When were you doing that? Alongside Wyke, when you were working at Wyke?
No, that's just been since I left work full Wyke full time.
Right.
The regional advisory job was just a 3-year contract that the DFVS, or whatever they were called at that stage, got for every subject to help implement the new changes to the new national curriculum at Key Stage 3.
That was in 2008?
I was doing it, yes. The first year I wasn't involved in it, and then I was appointed for 2008, and it ran until March this year, so right. March 2010.
So you visited quite a lot of schools when you
were there. Up in the northeast, yes. Well, yeah, quite a few. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. in your experience, a lot of them were dropping history in year nine.
Mm. Mm.
And did you feel there was a distinction between schools in affluent areas and schools in more challenging circumstances?
My gut instinct would say yes, but having said that, I don't think I went to any affluent schools in the northeast. By and large, they weren't the ones that were having the difficulties, or their teachers were confident that they weren't having difficulties, and they weren't the ones who were asking for subject advice. I mean, I went in to support and to share ideas, rather, but the teachers weren't necessarily struggling, but it was just to sort of make sure that they understood what was expected from the new curriculum and things. It was very interesting, but it didn't tend to be leafy suburb schools, they tended to be the poorer ones.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were to speculate, what could be offered to less able children that would make it worthwhile for them to study history up to 16?
Obviously, if you're going to make it compulsory and they're going to be doing it for 4 years at secondary school, 5 years at secondary school, they have to have some kind of outcome. So I think you've got to be able to give them something. I'm kind of reluctant to say it's got to be a qualification. I mean, I think you've got to offer a qualification, so you have to have the qualification that will lead through the academic path. And if you're not careful, then you're going to get two-tier. But at the same time, I think to make it interesting, you want to have an outcome so that they can say they've done it. But I would like just literally something that's going to say that they've done it. I mean, maybe the pass merit distinction sort of idea for a diploma or something, and make it much more hands-on, much more exploration. One of the things I find really frustrating about teaching GCSE, I just think kills history. I think it kills the source analysis. You do the kind of, you know, you're testing your skills by doing the Gobbett source analysis. I just think it's horrendous. And one of the things that I find frustrating is that I taught Russia for GCSE. And the only bit of the Russian history that really, really, really grabbed the kids was Rasputin. And he doesn't come up. He isn't at all. I mean, you can perhaps mention him as one of the reasons why the Tsar became more unpopular, but he's definitely an author, and if you're not careful, the kids write a whole paragraph because they just find him really interesting. And of course, they won't get any marks for it, really, because it's irrelevant. But I just think if you were doing a compulsory history, but a non-examinable thing, then you could say to them, right, okay, well, let's look at this man. What was his impact, I wonder? Was he really a womanizer? Or was he very attractive to women? How come women could possibly be attracted to someone with halitosis, BO, and bits of food in his beard? You know, let's see what evidence we can find. And I just think you could really engage them in doing that kind of thing. And actually, it's quite demanding. If you produce, I mean, I don't know where you get the sources from, but if I'm sure you could find some proper archive evidence and do a proper resourced inquiry into a really fascinating question. And it would be worthwhile. And you wouldn't have to have an exam which was going to reduce it to the sort of minimum, so that it might come up in the exam as an essay question, or it might come up as a Gobbett source, but it would be the interest and the kind of this inquiry, well, what really is the truth, would all be gone. So
then again, somebody might say, at 16, that young person won't really know about why Russia is the way it is, you know, why Mr. Putin is so attractive to the Russian public. It's got nothing to do with Rasputin, has it? They only know about Rasputin.
No.
They don't know about Lenin, Stalin, etc.
You've got to put it into a context. I mean, absolutely, you can't just do Rasputin. But I just think I mean, maybe Rasputin you wouldn't be able to spend all that long on anyway, but I mean, that gives you the skills base. That kind of inquiry would give you the skills base. You've got to put it into a context. And I mean, I think you could probably get quite interested in Stalin too, actually, and what impact he had. I mean, of course, the trouble is that when I get interested in Stalin, I want to know about all his childhood and about all his children and all the affairs he had with 13-year-old girls in Siberia and things. I just, you know, and of course, you're quite right, that's got nothing to do with why Mr. Putin is as he is. So then you have to try and decide, well, okay, if they're going to make it compulsory to 16, you start at that end and you say, what do we want 16-year-olds to know that is relevant to today? What kinds of things do they need to study? And then you need to find a way of putting that into context so that it makes sense. And I think you've got to be fairly careful about not getting too hung up on it when I think about it, because actually we have got an awful lot of children who know virtually no history at all. If they've done 2 years at Key Stage 3 and that's it, they're going to reach the age of 16 knowing absolutely nothing. So actually, if they know about how to do an inquiry into Rasputin, they probably know an awful lot more than most other children.
Just to finish, if you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be and to what age group?
Yes, when I saw that question, I thought, oh heck, where do I start? Because the trouble is that at any one time, I can be really enthusiastic about whatever I happen to be reading about. And the most recent thing that I got really enthusiastic and I want to go back and do more research on is about medieval and Tudor women, because I just think actually all this kind of women had a very secondary and very subservient role, I think is quite a Victorian sort of thing. And actually I think when you start investigating the role of Tudor women, okay, they had a separate role from their husbands, but actually they were really feisty and very well educated, a lot of them. I mean, obviously you tend to talk about the rich people being the well-educated one, but they were educated and to a very, very high level. So I think that's absolutely fascinating. However, having said that, I don't think it would engage the kids at school particularly, so I don't think I could teach it. I really enjoyed teaching the Native Americans and actually looking at the whole range of their initial culture and their initial way of life and how they have ended up in the way that they are in modern American society. And I think it really mirrors the Aboriginal people in Australia, and I think that you could probably teach in school, and I think it could be quite valuable, because I think how the present day situation for both the Aboriginal people and the Native Americans is horrendously upsetting, really. And I think it doesn't hurt to look at it and think, well, why and how could we have avoided this, and could we have avoided it, and what can be done to make them feel part of their own country, which I think certainly the Aborigines in Australia I don't think are. So I think probably that will be something that I would like to go back to teaching, and I don't teach at all at the moment.
All right. Thanks very much, Maggie.